And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm happy to have Natalie Bazile on the program today. Her debut novel, Queen Sugar, was much acclaimed when it was first released in 2014. It's now available in paperback from Penguin, and just a couple of days after I spoke with her, Oprah Winfrey announced that she and Ava DuVernay, the director of Selma, will be developing Queen Sugar into a television series. Charlie Bordelon is a young widow in Southern California, and her father has just passed away, and he's left her with a very unusual legacy.
He leaves her with 800 acres of sugarcane land in South Louisiana, which is a place that Charlie, when the book opens, does not know. She is a city girl. She lives in Los Angeles when the book starts. And the whole idea of South Louisiana is completely foreign to her. It's not a place where she grew up. And so at the beginning of the book, she decides to take a chance. And things in her life in Los Angeles haven't really gone the way she thought they would. So she picks up with her 11-year-old daughter, Micah, and heads down to this little small town in South Louisiana called St. Josephine, which is actually a fictitious version of three or four little towns that I spent a lot of time in when I was researching the book. Franklin, Jenneret, New Iberia. Those are the towns down there where I spent a lot of time. And so I kind of compressed all of those for the novel. And that's where Charlie goes. But I like to think of Charlie as somebody who is willing to take a chance and who's daring in her own way. And so I think she sees this as an opportunity to reinvent herself, even though she knows nothing about sugarcane at all. As a matter of fact, she tells the lawyer who kind of, you know, lets her know about her inheritance that as far as she's concerned, sugar grows on the baking aisle at the supermarket, right below the chocolate chips and the sprinkles. So that gives you some sense of the little bit that she knows and what she's getting herself into when the book starts.
And her mother is a successful, was it ophthalmologist?
Yes, yes.
And does not want her to go because there is still a stigma against the South for African Americans that live on the coast.
Right, that's right. Well, you know, in the book, Lorna really represents not just a different point of view, but a different experience. And in some ways, that mirrors my own parents. My dad is from Louisiana. He was born in a little town called Elton, which is near Lake Charles, and it's closer to the Texas border. But my mother is from Detroit. That's where she was born and raised. And, you know, she didn't really have any exposure to the South before she met my dad, met and married him. And so I wanted to try to explore that relationship, you know, this idea that some people have very deep roots and real connections to the South, and some people know the Midwest or African Americans, or they know the Northeast. And in the book, Lorna is very concerned about Charlie, you know, going to the South. And even though it's a contemporary story, she really has strong reservations about her daughter picking up and moving to this small town that, in her experience and based on what she's known about the South, is kind of a risky move. It's a risky move, and she doesn't know quite what Charlie's getting herself into and, yeah, is very concerned about her daughter's welfare.
This is not an autobiographical novel.
No.
But is it important for you to have kind of like these real-world touchstones and knowing what Louisiana is like and knowing your parents' experiences like in order to kind of like have a starting place?
Well, yes. And here's why. I could not have written this book if I had just been in my writing office in San Francisco. It would have been impossible. The key for me with this book was to have the experiences, to either be able to draw on my parents' experiences, particularly my dad's, but also for me to be able to, you know, engage with Louisiana and have that experience for myself, because the book is not autobiographical, but very much like Charlie, I am a person whose connection to the South did not begin as a child, in large part because, you know, my dad was born in 1937. And so his experience in the South, in Louisiana, was very conflicted. He was, you know, he was there as a young man during the height of segregation and really looked at the West. He looked at California, specifically Los Angeles, as the place of opportunity. And so he packed up and left on the night of his high school graduation, caught a ride to California with a woman from his town who needed help with the driving, and really didn't look back. And so growing up, I didn't really know Louisiana at all. I knew I had cousins there. My grandmother would write letters. Every 4, 5, 6 years, she would come out to visit. But we did not have those strong ties. I have one younger sister, and neither of us had the experience as children growing up. So in order for me to write this book, it was essential that I get to know the South for myself, get to know Louisiana for myself, and, you know, have those experiences. And I think the wonder and the amazement that I felt as the writer of the book is in many ways what Charlie experiences. You know, it's that sense that everything is so new and so different, and yet she knows that she has roots there.
What was the biggest surprise, positive or negative, you had when you went to Louisiana for the first time?
I would say the biggest positive surprise was how loyal and dedicated and open the people are who I met. Louisianans are very, very proud to be Louisianans. And so many people I met, you know, could trace their histories, you know, back 4, 5, 6 generations. And that's not something that I knew growing up. I can barely tell you, you know, where my grandparents are from. And so I was really shocked to see how deeply people are invested in their heritage and in their family's stories and their family ties. And so that was really impressive to me. I'll also say that I was just really charmed by how warm people were. You know, people were very willing to open up their homes, open up their lives, invite me to dinner, help me do research for the book. That was a real surprise to me. And I would say, on the other hand, I would say 95% of my time in Louisiana, I had a wonderful time and felt very welcomed and very just well taken care of. Every now and then, I would have an experience that would remind me, wow, I am really not in California. You know, I am really not in San Francisco. And although those moments, as few and far between as they were, they stung a little bit, you know, they were painful. But what they made me realize was why my dad, if I was experiencing the little, you know, maybe slights, and this was, you know, 2005 or 2007, I really could imagine what my dad must have experienced when he was there in 1957. So that was a good wake-up call for me, because the one thing I didn't want to do in this book, I didn't want to romanticize the South. I wanted to take an unflinching look, and I wanted to be honest. And Natasha Trethewey, the poet laureate, has this beautiful quote that I heard her say, where she talks about, in writing about the South, you have to embrace the things that are beautiful about the South and the things that are ugly. And I think that, not that I was looking for those more difficult moments, but it did give me a window into, you know, Southern history in a way that I could not have experienced if everything had just gone perfectly smoothly, you know, every time I visited.
Did it seem more complicated than you had first imagined it?
Much more. Much more. But, you know, I'm grateful for that. I like that complexity. I like the fact that things aren't as they seem. Things aren't just black and white, or, you know, there's really a mixing and an overlapping and an interweaving that happens. And as a writer, I couldn't have asked for richer stuff to work with.
And with Louisiana, you can't ask for a more unique place in America.
Exactly. It doesn't get, you know, much crazier than Louisiana, you know, because you have such a rich history. You've got Spanish and French and Caribbean culture and English, and it's just this wonderful, complicated mix of people and cultures and histories. And I think I could write about Louisiana, honestly, for the rest of my life and never run out of material.
When did you learn that humidity is not a joke?
You know, it's funny. People always say to me, why would you want to go to Louisiana in August? You know, why would you want to go in July when it is so horribly humid? But I'll tell you, coming from San Francisco, where I have been known to wear a turtleneck on the 4th of July because it is 50 degrees.
Because of Mark Twain.
Yes. I am more than happy to get down there in all the heat and just sweat it out. I love it. I love it. So it doesn't bother me at all. The first time I realized that the heat and the humidity in Louisiana was no joke was when I was out in the middle of August in the morning planting sugarcane with some migrant workers. And already by 7 o'clock, it was probably 85, 90 degrees with, 85% humidity. And I was in jeans and a long flannel shirt, to protect my arms while I was planting this cane. I have never been more hot or more miserable in all my life. And I loved it.
Now, at what point in your research did your eyes glaze over and you go, no more sugar research?
You know, that's a great question. Nobody's ever asked me that before, but I actually did have a moment on every visit when, and this may sound strange, but, because I'm not from Louisiana, everything there has this kind of shimmering quality to me. And that's kind of the way I tried to stay. I tried to stay in that mindset. And as soon as things began to feel ordinary to me, as soon as I began to feel like whatever I was doing in Louisiana was too much like what I could do in San Francisco, it was time to pack up and leave. And that was always the test for me. When did the place start to lose a little bit of its magic? That's when I would go home.
Now, of course, Charlie knows nothing about agriculture, let alone the peculiarities of sugarcane. And her father had employed a man to run the farm, essentially. And she gets there, she meets with him, and she's met with a very rude surprise.
Right. Well, that's the opening scene in the book. She has been counting on Wayne Frazier, who is essentially the foreman on the farm. She has been operating under this assumption since she inherited the land that he was going to be her right-hand man and that he was going to help her. And she gets down there and Frazier informs her that he's moving on, that he has a more secure job. And it's a rude awakening for her. But, they say in literature that when you're writing, you've got to raise the stakes for your characters. And I couldn't think of a better way for that to happen than for Charlie to have every single lifeline, every single rug pulled out from under her as the story began, because then she'd really be tested. Then she would really have to figure out how to survive and how to make this work when she doesn't have anyone to rely on, no expertise at all.
And she's already deep into the work season because she wanted to wait till Micah was finished with school before they went out. So all the good help is taken.
All the good help is taken. She's already lost 4 or 5 months, and so she has to scramble. And that was interesting for me. It was such a joy for me to be able to figure out, okay, how is she going to overcome these obstacles, when she doesn't know anything? And that was also fun because I had a very dear friend of mine. His name is Rene Simon. And at the time I started writing Queen Sugar, he was a sugarcane farmer. And so I would call Rene with those type of questions. So if she gets down there and it's June and she should have started in March, what is she going to be up against? And what are the challenges that she's going to face? And how is she going to survive? And Rene, because he lived that life every day, would be able to help me understand just how much harder her life would be because she's up against it in every way.
So when the story first comes to you, do you have Charlie or do you have the idea of what she has to go through first?
I had Charlie first. This book took 11 years for me to write.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. I started June 15th, 1999. I used to work in my family's business. My dad had a business in Los Angeles selling aluminum to the aerospace and aircraft industry. And so even though I knew I needed to write, that was really my calling, I spent 11 years working for my dad in sales, essentially. And I would come home at night and I would write. But on June 15th, 1999, that's when I actually went into my dad's office and told him for the second time, I need to leave. I really have to write. And I can remember driving, because his business was in the industrial part of Los Angeles, where all of the trains intersected and all this stuff. And I can remember driving across these railroad tracks after I had essentially quit, thinking, holy cow, what have I done? Now I better write this book. But for the first 6 years that I wrote the book, it was really set in a fictitious version of the town where my dad grew up. It didn't become a sugarcane book until 2005, when I went back to Louisiana for a friend's birthday party. Her family lived in New Iberia, Louisiana, which is smack dab in the middle of sugarcane country. And after that weekend, I essentially picked up the book that I had been writing that didn't have anything to do with sugarcane, but had Charlie in it. And I set it down in sugarcane country. And so I had Charlie and Micah and the whole cast of characters first, but I didn't have that essential element, that sugarcane, until 2005.
Did you learn anything from your sales career that helped you sell the book?
That's actually a good question. I look at that part of my life as being so different. That's kind of some other person. Maybe my love of writing, maybe my experience in sales helped me, because I think my love of writing, my passion comes across. And I think that's the difference, because, you know, my dad, he was just a natural salesman. He could sell anything. And so for him, it didn't matter whether it was aluminum or buttons or, you know, shoes. He could have sold anything. I'm not like that. I really need to believe in the product. I need to feel that passion, which is part of the reason I left. And so I think if my old life in sales served me at all, it was in making me maybe a little less afraid to talk about this thing that I love so much, which is writing and books and storytelling. That's probably the best way to think about it. I'd never thought about that before, but that's good.
Now, while this is a farm, it doesn't have the big Greek Revival plantation house on the property. So Charlie and Micah need some place to live, and they stay with their grandmother, her father's mother, Ms. Honey.
Mm-hmm. It was very important to me in this book to give Charlie a realistic challenge. I didn't want to give her so much land, 2,000 or 3,000 acres, that someone who is really a Louisiana sugarcane farmer would open up the book and say, there's no way she could do this on her own. It had to ring true. So I wanted to give her enough land for it to be a challenge for her, but not too much land that it would be unrealistic. And, you know, she's farming 800 acres, which is already a decent amount of property. But, you know, the circumstances are she is struggling. She has a very small operating budget. Right now, I think you can't buy a used combine for less than, you know, probably $150,000. And Charlie has $90,000 to work with. To give her a sprawling plantation house, a sprawling mansion, didn't ring true to the kind of story I was trying to tell. It didn't ring true to Charlie's experience as a small farmer. And so I just wanted the book to be grounded in things that were real.
The relationship with her grandmother isn't kind of your typical, I'm your grandmother, I'll always love you. There is some prickliness to the relationship.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, Miss Honey is the one character in the book who is inspired by someone in my family. My grandmother, Miss Rose, was very much like Miss Honey. You know, it was kind of her way or the highway. And when you were in her presence, she was the person who, you know, ran the show, and everybody else kind of had to fall in line. And she was that way with her family. She was that way with her church. She was that way with all the people in her town where she lived. And that can be a wonderful thing, but it also can be something that smothers you. And so I wanted Miss Honey to embody all of those qualities, because I think that that's family. You know, if she had been all sugar and molasses, that wouldn't have made for a good story. And so I wanted her to have that prickliness. I wanted her to have a bit of a bite to her, you know, and I wanted Charlie to have that experience. Because the other thing that is true for Charlie, that was true for me, you know, living out in California, I did not have the blessing of growing up with, you know, another generation right kind of at my doorstep. And so I wanted Charlie to have that experience of that those intergenerational relationships, you know, and to figure out what that's like, because I think that that is a way of being that is really passing. You know, I don't know of a lot of people my age who can say, I grew up with my grandmother. I knew my family. Maybe they can more in the South, but certainly you don't have that in the West because people are always moving, always relocating. And so I wanted her to have that experience and have to learn what it means to negotiate with someone who is your elder.
But the person she becomes closest to in her family is Violet, her
That's
aunt.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Violet is her big sister, her confidant, her anchor, her rock. Violet is just everything to her. I really love that relationship. I love all the relationships in the book, but the relationship that Charlie has with Violet, you know, who really calls it like it is one that was fun for me to write. And it was also fun for me to explore the relationship that Violet has with Miss Honey, because that is a mother-daughter relationship that I thought was an interesting echo of the relationship that Charlie has with her own daughter, Micah. So again, it was really fun for me to, you know, have these three or four layers of women all interacting within the family.
Now, early on in the book, we also meet another character out west.
Yes.
Who has his own kind of third-person narration that gets followed, because mainly the narration follows Charlie and this new character we're introducing now, and that's Ralph Angel.
Yeah, Ralph Angel, who, you know, always will occupy a special place in my heart because he is Charlie's half-brother. He has not inherited any land, where Charlie has gotten everything. And there are reasons for that that you find out in the book. But I wanted Ralph Angel to be, in some ways, kind of the flip side of Charlie. You know, they're very similar in some ways, but very different in others.
And they both lost their spouses.
They've both lost their spouses. They both have young children who they're, you know, struggling to raise. They're both very devoted and very concerned about being good parents. But Ralph Angel has his flaws, as does Charlie. And in Ralph Angel's case, I always like to think of him as the character who, in his heart of hearts, wants to do the right thing, wants to make good choices, but just, for the life of him, just is his own worst enemy. And that's the way I think of him in the book. I think of him not so much as an unlikable character, but more of a tragic character in the book. And it's been so interesting to me to have readers come to me and say, you know, I have a Ralph Angel in my family, too. I know this character. I know this personality, you know, or I have an uncle who's just like Ralph Angel, or I have a sister who's just like Ralph Angel. And they will thank me for having Ralph Angel's story interwoven with Charlie's, because without him, the book would be a different book. He has to be there, I feel. And readers have reflected that back to me, that for all of the tragedy and the sadness and the difficulty that he brings, he gives the book a certain kind of balance that it needs. I think without Ralph Angel in the book would have been too good, too syrupy sweet, and that's not what I was going for.
And it seems like his biggest failing is not being able to see that there is a process to getting to where what you want.
That's right. That's right. I mean, Ralph Angel, he has a sense of entitlement. He's impatient. He also, to some degree, is a little delusional about his own abilities. But that's all interesting to me, you know? I mean, I think we all have crossed paths with people who things just don't add up in their own minds. For some reason, they're not quite grounded. And I wanted to explore what that kind of person would be like. Ralph Angel has certainly been the victim of circumstance in one respect, which is the reason why he did not inherit any land. But on the other hand, you know, he is entirely responsible for some of the decisions that he made in his life. And so to have that kind of complexity embodied in one character was certainly interesting to me.
And while we do feel bad for Ralph Angel, we feel just horribly for his son, Blue.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, Blue's a kid. He's 7 in the book, totally innocent. Giving Ralph Angel something to focus on aside from his own troubles was essential. And I think that that is one of the ways in which he's redeemed in the book, because he's so devoted to his son and wants desperately to do the right thing and be a good dad. And I think that that aspect of his personality helps to make him, if not more likable, then certainly more sympathetic. Because, you know, anybody who has a child understands what that's like, you know, the weight of that responsibility. And I think Ralph Angel feels that weight in a way that even Charlie doesn't. And Charlie's haunted in her own way. But Blue is the one thing in his life that he thinks he has done a decent job at protecting.
Ralph Angel has ambition, but not a good deal of follow-through.
That's true.
But his childhood friend, Hollywood, who still lives in the neighborhood, the Quarters, has no ambition, but as much follow-through as a person can have.
That's so true. And, you know, Hollywood, again, I just love that character. You know, he's quiet. He's modest. He's a humble man.
He's Creole, which
he's
is
Creole.
A bit different class-wise.
Very much so. And, you know, again, Hollywood was an opportunity for me to kind of explore this strange aspect of Louisiana culture. I don't mean to say that Creoles are strange. I'm just saying that, you know, for Hollywood to kind of occupy this position where he's not white, but he's not African-American black the way Charlie is. You know, he kind of occupies this other space that historically in Louisiana, you know, the free people of color, the Creoles, they have been kind of their own class of people. And yet he is drawn to Miss Honey. He's drawn to the warmth and the life and the family that she represents because he doesn't have that in his own life. And he is not affluent. Nobody in the Quarters affluent, but Hollywood and his people are even less well off than Miss Honey and Charlie are. And that was, again, interesting to me because that's Louisiana. All of the class questions, the race questions, the culture questions, they're all at play all the time. And it's fascinating to me.
Well, and the race question comes up most strongly when she's dealing with the sugar co-op people.
Right. Well, you know, the truth is Charlie is an African-American woman working in an industry that is dominated by white men. That's just the fact. And to have her have that experience and not have it be an experience that is in some cases fraught would not have been honest. You know, if she had just kind of sailed in there and not suddenly felt all the ways that she was an outsider, would not have been true to the experience, you know. And it's also so interesting to me because, you know, right now in Louisiana, there are only 480 family farmers. And by family farmers, I mean farmers who either own or farm less than 1,000 acres. There are only 480. Anything beyond that is owned by a corporation, right? Of that 480, there are only 10 black farmers left. So that was a thread that I wanted to explore because, like many of the white farmers, over time they've sold out. Their kids don't want to be farmers anymore. They don't want to be in that industry. They move away from the small towns.
But it's a state that has a third African-American population.
Exactly. And for so few African-American farmers to be part of that today really says something. And of that 480, there are only 5 women farming. So for Charlie to go down there and try to make a go of it, all the odds are stacked against her. You know, in some ways, she kind of doesn't stand a chance, you know, just if you go by the numbers. And so that was interesting to me to see how she would manage and how she would negotiate and how she would maneuver in this world that, you know, like Prosper Denton tells her in the book, you know, in some ways is really kind of inside baseball. I think that's the phrase.
She experiences a number of different racial hurts.
Yes.
And some of them being very intentional, some of them being unintentional.
Yes.
But I enjoyed the character of Allison, who's
a
poor white farmer who's losing his farm.
Exactly.
And he's wanting to help out Charlie because he views class as a much more important thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, in so many instances, the question of class was just as compelling to me as the question of race. You know, if Charlie has gotten a raw deal, Allison really has gotten a raw deal because he's supposed to be part of that establishment. And yet he's a struggling farmer. He's lost his lease. He can't wait to kind of get back at, you know. Stick it to the man, right. The people, you know, who have more power than he has ever had. That was so important to me in the book, was to not just draw straight lines and say, okay, well, all the white people are bad, or, you know, all the black people are good, or all the white people are middle and upper class, and all the black people are, you know, working class. It's a mix. And that, again, is what I think makes Queen Sugar an interesting read. It makes it more complicated because that's, again, you know, that represents the complexity of Louisiana. You've got everything operating all at the same time.
Now let's go technical.
Okay.
Could you kind of explain to us the four-year cycle for cane?
Oh, yes. Okay. So sugarcane grows, imagine a bamboo shoot, okay, or a stalk of bamboo. It looks pretty much like that because it's a grass, just like bamboo is. And when you plant sugarcane, you have to lay that sugarcane stalk in the row, like in a little trench. And where all of the joints are on the sugarcane, that's where the sprouts come up. And so a farmer can plant a stalk of sugarcane and know that for 4 years, that stalk is going to send up a little shoot at every one of those little nodules. But after 4 years, that sugarcane stalk has really exhausted itself, and the yield starts to go down. And so you have to dig that stalk up. That's called the mother stalk. And every year you get another cutting off of that. It's called first year stubble or second year stubble or third year stubble or fourth. And by the time you get to the fourth year, it's time to dig up that original stalk and replant it. And so the way farmers work is they're always rotating and kind of cycling through their fields because they'll segregate, you know, kind of separate one quarter of their land and it'll have a brand new planting on it. And then the other three quarters are in that first, second, or third phase of sending up the stalks. So they're always planting and harvesting, you know, three quarters to one quarter.
So do they ever have to leave the fields fallow to regenerate the soil?
Or? You know, not really. It's not like rice, right? Rice farmers in Louisiana alternate between planting rice and then harvesting crawfish on the same land. For that very reason, they need to give the soil a chance to rest. I don't know exactly what crawfish do, but they, you know, help to reinvigorate the soil. And then it also means that they have...
And it's called pooping.
I think so. Probably so. That's a perfect way, right. But with sugarcane, at least to my knowledge, they don't do that. You know, they fertilize the soil mm-hmm. and do other things. But no, sugarcane farmers pretty much stick to sugarcane. Now, they might plant soybeans, but for the most part, it's pretty much sugarcane. Well, they probably do plant soybeans, come to think of it. But in Charlie's case, it's only sugarcane.
Did you ever feel bad for all the obstacles you kept throwing her way?
Never. That's like the first rule of writing, is the more obstacles, the more difficulty you can throw at a character, the better. You know, you don't want to exhaust them. You don't want to exhaust your reader. But, you know, it's like in real life. People show who they really are when their backs are up against it, you know, when they have to figure out how to survive. And so the more I could do that for Charlie on every front, not just with her farm, but with Ralph Angel, with Miss Honey, with Charlie, the more trouble I could get her into, the more difficulty she had to face, the more rich and interesting she became, because she becomes a real person at that point.
So 15 years
yes.
for the makings of Queen Sugar.
Yeah.
Hopefully, can you go to a four-year cycle like Sugar
Cane? Hopefully. The next book has got to take me less time.
Do you have a start to it?
I do. I have another book in mind that I'm reading for and researching now. The benefit is now I've written a book. I can't say that I can apply every lesson that I learned from the first book to the second book. But now I know a little bit more, you know, and so I have some new challenges that I'm kind of setting up for myself. But at least I've done it once, you know. So, no, I don't think the next book will take 15 years or 11. I'm hoping for maybe 4 years, 5 years, something like that. But, you know, then again, a book at some point takes as long as it takes. And I don't really want to rush just to put another book out in the marketplace. I'm not interested in that. I want to tell a good story. I want whatever I write to ring true and to be satisfying. And if that takes 5 years, great. If it takes 9 years, you know, that's okay too, because I would much rather know that the next book I'm putting out into the world is rich and textured and as complicated as I can make it.
So I'm guessing this wasn't a two-book deal.
No, this was, thank goodness. Thank goodness. No, just one book. My publisher, Pam Dorman, has the option, the right of first refusal on whatever I write next. And, you know, we've agreed we want to work together. But no, I do not have the pressure of having to bang out another book in a year. I don't know how I would do that.
And you've gotten glowing reviews for the book. How much has that meant to you?
Oh, you know, it's meant a lot. I mean, it's very gratifying. You know, anytime somebody reads the book and enjoys what I've written and sees all that's gone into it, I'm very grateful for that. You know, it's so interesting. I had one really fabulous conversation with an interviewer in Los Angeles, and she made the observation, and I never heard anybody say this before, but she said, you know, you can read Queen Sugar up here, you know, just read it for the lovely story, or you can read it down here, which is the way you obviously have read it, with a nose for some of the more complicated themes, the trickier questions. And I'm so grateful for that. I'm so grateful to interviewers who tune into a different frequency with the book. I don't want to hit readers over the head, but that's what I was trying to say. When you ask questions about race, when you ask questions about class, when you ask those questions, those were the things that were on my mind when I was writing. And, you know, again, I don't want to hit readers over the head and be preachy about this stuff, but I always admire the books that operate on more than one level. And I always appreciate it when reviewers, interviewers see that that's what I was trying to do with this book. So yes, I'm very grateful for all the reviews, the glowing ones. I'm particularly grateful for the reviews that pointed out some of these other issues.
Well, Natalie, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today and
thank
sharing
you.
Queen Sugar with
thank
us. It's been
so
a pleasure.
Much. Thank you. It was a terrific interview, and I just appreciate it so much.
Natalie Bazile is the author of Queen Sugar, which is now in paperback from Penguin. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.